Welcome to TFP, the Theater Folk Podcast, the place to be for drama teachers, drama students, and theater educators everywhere. I'm Lindsay Price, resident playwright for Theater Folk. Hello! Hello! I hope you're well. Thanks for listening. This is episode 164. You can find any links to this episode in the show notes, which are at theaterfolk.com/episode164. Okay, so some of my favorite episodes, they're all my favorite episodes. I love this podcast. I love hearing from you guys when you like come up to us at the Theater Folk table when we're at a conference and you tell us, listen to the podcast, you listen to it in your cars. Somebody was cleaning out his office or painting his office and listened to the podcast. That is like the best. I'm glad that it's something that appeals to you guys, that is informative for you guys. I hope that there's something that you guys get out of it. That's why we're doing it. We do it. We're doing it for you. And so this, I think, was a very interesting one to put together. And hope it's interesting for you, too. So what we've got here is I really love it when we can get more than one voice involved on whatever topic. So we can hear more than one point of view. And today we've got four. So we've got four teachers talking about their vision, their experience, their success and struggles with directing. Not just any play, a Shakespeare play. And what they're all have experience with is directing A Midsummer Night's Dream. So how do we take this play? How do you interpret it? And how you illuminate the bard, both for your audience and for your students? So here's a little hint of what's coming. John Hughes does Shakespeare. I know, eh? Pretty good. Okay, so let's get to it. Okay, I'm talking to Marcia Wallner. Hello, Marcia.
Hello.
Awesome. Okay, we're talking Dream. And just before we got started, you identified that Midsummer Night's Dream, favorite production, favorite play. Good place
this
to start.
Is true. Very true.
So what makes it your favorite play?
I think because it's just so fun. I mean, that's kind of the easy answer, that it's silly and fun and magical and exciting. And it's just silly. And I love that. And then, of course, there's the deeper meanings that you can extrapolate when you really dig deep into it. And I love doing that in terms of working with older actors. This particular production was a group of K through 12 students. So I had everything from little tinies that just wanted to be silly up through high school actors who really wanted to get serious. And this play really provided that.
What a wide range of students to work with.
Yes.
So your sanity was kept?
It was. And that all came from a very meticulously created rehearsal schedule.
Perfect. Okay, so but let's step back and let's start about look at your vision. So when you're looking at this play, you love this play, you know you're working with students, what are some of your first thoughts when you were thinking about how you were going to present it?
Well, my main thought was how to stay true to the material and really work with the language. Obviously, with Shakespeare, that can be a challenge for students, so especially working with really young students. So really thinking of ways that I could make it both deep and intellectual for older students as well as still fun for the younger ones. So we incorporated a lot of movement, and for the very youngest, we did some choreography for them. There was kind of a little boys versus girls thing happening amongst the young fairies. So I kind of invented a lot of little ways that they could have little rounds of battle throughout the show, kind of nonverbal sort of interactions. And then it all, of course, culminates when things culminate between the older characters. So just incorporating a lot of appealing material for the kids I'd be working with, their age is.
Yeah. Did you have a specific look for the show or something you were going for?
Sure, yeah. With the sort of real world elements, I went with kind of a classic ancient Greek, you know, the long toga type look and kind of militaristic. And then with the fairies, of course, lots of tulle and sparkle and some more unnatural kind of lighting. in terms of design elements. So to really draw that distinction between the real world and the dream world, and doing that through all those design elements.
Yeah, it's interesting that you you identify the real world as sort of a military world, which is quite true. I mean, that's what I'm not sure I've ever heard it described in that way, which gives such a lovely picture, doesn't it? Like, you can really get into visuals as to what a military look might be.
Yeah, and it's interesting because I think a lot of times with this play, it's seen as a romance. It's seen as very, you know, lovely, and especially after the Hoffman movie from 1999, the one with Kevin Kline. Beautiful movie, don't get me wrong, but definitely very romantic in the human world. And if you think back on some of the origins, the relationship between Theseus and Hippolyta was of war and conquest. You know, it wasn't particularly romantic. So I didn't want to delve super deep into that because, of course, we wanted to have a fun production that has some of those, you know, romantic elements. But acknowledging that that's the other side of the story.
Well, and also the relationship between Aegeus and Hermia, you know, like full vexation come I against my daughter Hermia. Let's kill her, you know.
Yep.
Not funny, but exactly so, that there is that element to it. And I think too, like, the more you play up that element, then the more of the other, the more fun and the more otherworldly, I think is the word you use, which I think is really great. The forest seems.
Exactly.
Did you have a team when it came to the look of your show in terms of costume and sound and set, or are you a one-man band?
Sort of. There was a bit of a team. Yeah. This was in an independent school, so I was directing, and then we had a set designer who worked full-time in the school, and he did all of the set elements and kind of all the backstage stuff, and then he brought in an artist who did lighting design. And I had a student costume designer that I had been working with for a couple years before this. And so this was her first production that she really took on by herself as a designer. So kind of a little team of combination of local professionals, in-house staff, and students.
And how did you, so what are some things that you said to communicate what you were looking for in the production to your team when they went off and started work on their own elements?
Sure. I was lucky in that the set designer was somebody that I saw every day, and we worked together every day. So there was a lot of just casual conversation as we thought of ideas and different little things that we could include. So that was a little bit unconventional in that we were able to have a considerable amount of conversation and kind of see things as they came together and give each other feedback. So that was how that worked out in terms of set. With lighting, it was a lot of, you know, there's the two worlds, you know, just kind of talking about the basics of the emotion. I guess that's how I usually communicate to designers, is here's the emotion I want to get across, and then allow them to make their own creative choices that exemplify that.
Oh, I think that's an excellent way to describe vision. And I think that's a good thing for anyone listening when they are trying to think of a way to verbalize what they want to someone, to somebody else who's going to build. Because it's really easy. We have a lot of directors who are, they usually do everything themselves. And then if they have to, you know, give over an aspect, get over that baby to somebody else,
right,
it can be really hard to do. And I think that, just as you said, describing it in terms of emotion, because that gives them you can explain without saying, you know, build this set piece, but then they can think about that aspect of it. I think it's really
right. And some of it has to do with functional elements. You know, for example, I told the set designer, so it's a forest, so I'd like some trees, but I want them to be able to climb in the trees. So hopefully they're weight bearing and structurally sound. So things like that. And like I say, we were able to have a lot of just day-to-day conversations about things, and the actors were able to rehearse on the set, on the stage. So as we would discover, well, that area there needs a little bit of work, or maybe, you know, so some of those more nitty gritty structural things kind of came about as well, just through, okay, now we know sort of aesthetically what we want. Now we have to make it functional.
That's another great point, that what is the functionality of mm-hmm. this set, and also the functionality of costumes too, you know,
right.
like does an actor have to move in this costume, mm-hmm. Particularly with the fairies, you know, that mm-hmm. If you want movement, then the costumes have to accommodate.
Absolutely.
What was it like working with a student? You've worked with a student director, a costume designer before, but it's a little mm-hmm. bit different relationship. And
right.
was it a learning experience? Was she just like on board and like was able to bring everything to the table?
She was definitely very enthusiastic about the artistry of her position, which was great to have. And we had worked on, like I say, a couple shows previous where I had functioned as costume designer for a different director, and she was kind of my assistant. So I was able to kind of set the tone for a lot of the tasks and how to accomplish things really professionally, and she really came through. I was really very impressed with her maturity and her ability to do things like conduct fittings and kind of do a costume parade and be able to give actors notes in a really professional way. So I was really proud of how that all came about. And it came about from letting her work her way through all those steps and being really intentional about cultivating those skills in the students, as opposed to, hey, student, all of a sudden you're going to be a costume designer. Go.
Yeah. Oh, what a great experience for her.
Yeah. Yeah. I was really glad to make that happen for her.
Okay. So let's talk about the text. How do mm-hmm. you work on a text, like, even as fun and as lighthearted as A Midsummer Night's Dream is, it's still Shakespeare, and there's still mm-hmm. the language barrier and the communication barrier. It's really important that actors be able to communicate their characters. I find sometimes that's the thing that gets missing with Shakespeare, is we spend so much time on the language that the characters aren't as full as they sometimes can be. What do mm-hmm. you do when it comes to communicating the script to your actors?
Sure. With the younger actors, again, a lot of movement. And even sometimes with the older group, like the mechanicals, you know, we did a lot of kind of slapstick movement stuff that helped them get a better handle on character before having to really put that into the dialogue. So getting a lot of opportunity to work on ensemble and physicality and kind of get all that under control, and then start applying that to the text. So kind of a little backwards way of doing it, but I felt it was successful with this group.
I think that can work. I think it can work, you know, like if they get it into their bodies first.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then figure out the language.
Right. Yeah, and giving a lot of opportunity for fun sort of character moments that don't have the pressure of the language. So, for example, when the mechanicals first appeared, they would come in sort of one at a time, and there was we kind of developed this little teasing relationship between Starveling and Snout, and they would kind of pick on Snug. And so we developed all these little slapsticky kind of things that they would do. And then Bottom comes in with this, we had this prop giant sword, and the kids were like, we have to use this somehow. So I let the actor playing Bottom kind of come out with it as though she were balancing it. It was a female who played the role. And it was just a lot of just fun, kind of silly stuff that sets the tone for the relationships and the dynamics. And then we would get into the text.
So you took a very classical approach to presenting A Midsummer Night's Dream.
Mm-hmm.
How did you work with your students to make these characters relatable?
Ah, that is a great question. I talked a lot with the four lovers, and I put that in finger quotes, the
yeah.
four lovers, a lot with them about how is this like high school right now? You know, these kind of jockeying of relationships and wanting to follow your heart, but having pressures either from a peer or a parent, and just kind of taking all of those themes and applying them to what might be happening today. And some of them, without going into great detail, of course, would tell me that they had experienced similar things of various different degrees. So really making it relatable, not just generally relatable, but specifically to their own experience. And I usually have, when time allows, have actors do some biographical writing, you know, and maybe write themselves an additional monologue in modern English, but just kind of addressing some of those emotions that they're experiencing and finding other ways to connect to it beyond just the text and what I'm coaching them in.
Were these students, did they have a lot of experience with Shakespeare, or was it new for, I'm assuming with some of the little ones, it was new, and how did how did their relationship with Shakespeare change through your process?
Well, I was fortunate in that a lot of these students have experienced the text in English classes. So again, I was fortunate in that they had a pretty thorough experience. Most of what we were dealing with was sort of the basics of relationships and character building. The language itself was relatively natural for them. And I know that's unusual. So I think I was lucky in that respect. But when working with a group who isn't necessarily familiar, like some of the younger students, again, just going back to what is the purpose of what you're saying, and how would you paraphrase this or restate it in modern English, and sort of using that as a tool to help understand meaning, and then determining where things like inflection and emphasis go within the language itself. And there's plenty of the poetry to kind of hang your hat on in terms of feeling comfortable about it and letting it come out naturally, is that it does flow naturally. So allowing yourself to get beyond, I don't know what this means, to a place of appreciating and understanding not only the meaning, but just the beauty of the language.
That's lovely. I love that. That's a really great approach. And as we wrap up here, and then how was the response? What was the, who was in your audience, and how did they take to this, to the story?
Yeah, it was mostly families. It was a school production. So majority of the audience is families and teachers and school community. And they all really enjoyed it. There was always the feeling of gratitude from the younger families, you know, because I had, of course, kindergartners in the play as some of the younger fairies, and their families were just so grateful, not only for the experience, but the opportunity to work with the older students. That was one of the best things about this particular production. And many folks would say, oh my gosh, kindergartners through 12th graders, that's such an unmanageable range. But it worked out that they all sort of paired off, and those students that were a little more sort of nurturing might gravitate to the younger students and want to coach them. And I think I was intentional about setting that tone of kind of a little community and taking care of each other. And I think that reads when the performance happens, and you see Puck come down the aisle through the audience with three little boys and kind of coaching them along. And I think that was evident. And that was some of the feedback I got, was what a great way to bridge that age gap and put together something really fun for them, because of course it's about them. It's not about me necessarily. It's about the kids.
Well, I think that's great. And it sort of makes it, then it's not really about Shakespeare. It's about community and
exactly.
And mentorship. Like, what a great thing to pass on to your students. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. Oh,
love it. Love it. Oh, thank you so much, Marcia, for
You're
talking
so welcome.
To us today.
Yeah, it was my pleasure. It was very fun to kind of relive the memories.
Cool. And now I am speaking to Kelly Raganti. Hello, Kelly.
Hello, how are you?
I'm excellent, thank you.
Great.
Now, we are talking Shakespeare, and we are talking A Midsummer Night's Dream, and you have an extra level to that in that you are a middle school teacher.
Yes, I am. And, 6th, 7th, and 8th grade teacher.
And I think that is, first of all, I think it's fantastic that you are doing Shakespeare with your students. What is, and did you do the whole thing? Did you do a cutting? Did you,
We did the whole thing. We did an adapted version, but as I went back and compared the text, they were pretty similar. Some of the meatier monologues were just kind of cut. But in terms of the language and the verbiage from, you know, I have a first folio copy, and I was looking at the adapted version. They were fairly similar.
So you're using original language, and you're just
yes.
basically, I find with Shakespeare, there's a lot of this happens. And let me tell you about this thing that happened. We don't necessarily need for today's audiences.
Yes. Yeah, definitely. Let me expound on that.
Yeah,
and let
yeah,
me
yeah,
tell
yeah.
you even more how I feel.
And why did you, or have you always just thought that Shakespeare would be great for your students?
I always have in terms of picking this particular play for this set of students. I always kind of look at my students and think, what would they do well? You know, what the shows that I pick, you know, what would really harness their strengths? And I had such an interesting mixture, just a great mixture of kids with all different various levels. You know, sometimes we do musicals, we'll do straight plays, and I something just clicked and I thought, oh my gosh, these kids would be great for Midsummer. So they kind of cast themselves, you know, as I'm looking around and I see all these characters. So it just kind of happened, you know, and it came, that kind of spirit just kind of came to me and I'm like, oh, we definitely need to do this.
Yeah, well, these characters, I mean, there's nothing clearer than, I think, the characters in A Midsummer Night's Dream when you're when you're just looking at comparing your students and then putting them into the roles. So where did you start with this play? So you started with your students, actually. You started with your students, and then when you started to look at how you were going to present the piece, what were your thoughts in terms of staging and vision?
Well, the overall vision for the show, I wanted it to be engaging for our audience, which would be predominantly a middle school audience. And then we also have some of our elementary schools around the district come see the shows. So we were going to have a wide range of audience members. You know, on some nights we'd have those elementary school students. The majority of the time would be the middle school students. And then, of course, we'd have the parent shows. And so I wanted it to be engaging for them. And so some of the choices that I made, I really tried to almost make the audience feel like they were a part of it. So that's why we did it in a three-quarter round. And another reason
it's so funny. I'm looking at your pictures and I'm nodding. I'm like, no one can hear me nod. No one can hear me nod. Yeah, the thrust stage, I think, is a really, really... For that exact thing about really involving your audience, it's just so immediate, huh?
Yes. And it was crazy. You can see it. They can't see, but in some of the pictures, the faces of the people in the audience, they just feel like they're in it, which was so rewarding, especially for the kids, because they were, you know, very up close and personal with their audience, and so it made it almost intimate. And it just took their acting, their performance, their level of play to this unreal level. And it was so cool because it was Shakespeare. And that hit on another part, which is I wanted it to be fun for them. And they still talk about it. It's been over a year and they still go back to Midsummer, the ones that were there, and they say, that was fun. And for a middle school student to say, even after rehearsing all of those lines of Shakespeare and talking about the subjects and what it really meant, it was so fun. And it showed every night that they performed. It was really magic. So
yeah, you can really, it's something that even does come across in pictures. And there's a couple of things I want to bring up. I really like your idea of, because vision is something that's really important, and it's especially important in Shakespeare, but it doesn't have to be complicated. And I love your idea that the vision is engagement. And that you did this really neat thing where it looks like the woods are all around the audience.
Yes.
Where so that they're not outside the world, they're inside the world.
They are. And the space is kind of peculiar. It's an auditorium, but it's almost like this can be turned into this giant black box with this kind of, you know, elevated stage performing area and one space. So I really did want to bring the audience into the world, especially if the Shakespearean language was going to be a barrier for some of them. They automatically, immediately felt like they were in it. And so in our classroom discussions, we got to talk about Shakespeare's Globe, and we got to talk about the Groundlings, and, you know, to hear your students say back to you, oh, well, our audience is like the Groundlings. Yes! Yes! Yeah. And I also really wanted to make it relevant. It was really important to me in terms of the kids having fun, the audience having fun, and then everybody being engaged, was to bring contemporary elements to it. We all know that Shakespeare's plays are extremely versatile, and Midsummer was just a blast to play with some of the characters and bring in, you know, some of these choices, especially for the mechanicals, to just bring the audience in, you know, even more, awesome. Especially younger audience.
Yeah. So talk about that. How did you make the, so let's start with the mechanicals and how you made them relevant. The first thing I noticed in their costumes is that they're basically dressed like middle school students. Like they seem to be like there's, if I'm, unless I'm guessing the wrong people. So tell me, so you tell me.
Sure. No problem. You're right. I mean, we had conversations about, you know, mortality rates in Elizabethan England and, you know, in Shakespeare's plays. And so I said, you know, these characters, some of them aren't far from your age groups, you know, and especially when we were talking about the relationships with the lovers and like love triangles, and they're like, oh my gosh, that happens every day at middle school. But for the mechanicals, as I'm reading the play and I'm looking at my kids, I saw like a guild. I'm in San Diego, so I'm just thinking of Comic-Con, and I thought, oh my gosh, you know, they're all called tinkerers, and you know, they're a guild. So I said, they're coming in on scooters. They're going to go through the woods on scooters. They're going to come in from every direction. They're going to be part of a fandom, and they're going to like LARP. They're going to, do you know what LARPing is?
No, tell me.
It's like live action role play.
Yes. Okay.
Yeah. So I wanted them to be a band of, you know, like gamers that met up and were like, we're going to go LARP and put on this, you know, production. And if it's good enough, then we can do it in front of the king, in front of the duke. And so one of them's part of the Harry Potter fandom. Another one's Percy Jackson. Let's see what else. A Doctor Who. There's some other game. Oh, bottom is Pokemon. So it lended to each one of their personalities, and it made it so much easier for them to connect. And it really ended up being, I mean, they're always the comic relief, but they absolutely stole the show and the play within the play. You know, it was almost like the actors costumed themselves and said, you know, how would we show off this love affair? And it was ended up being Mario and Peach, and it just unstoppable laughter from the audience. So it was really cool.
Is that something that you had in your head, or is that something that developed as you saw these characters, students bring these characters to life?
It's something I already had in my head. I did a production in college my college did a production of Midsummer, and the mechanicals were actually these versions of nerds. They were kind of more like software engineers. And I just really loved that concept. And I thought, how could I take that kind of play and approach to these characters, but still, you know, make it relevant for middle school and kind of connect it to our community? It's a big, big fandom community out here because mm-hmm. of Comic-Con and stuff. So
that is really cool. Yeah. So talk a little about, so that is sort of like the overall reaching, like the vision, we have the characterization, we have the costumes. How were you communicating the language and getting them to be, and more importantly, getting them to be able to communicate the language to the audience?
Well, our rehearsals were kind of two-parters. So they had the script. And then they also downloaded an app onto their school iPads, where it was basically like a translation, Shakespeare translation. So if they got stuck, you know, they would go to it. But I found that they didn't really want to. they wanted to figure out what the language was saying. So we had tons of conversation, you know, it would be kind of like me asking a question to them and them trying to make, you know, the answer to that question, you know, and take that and try to correlate it to the text without me outright telling them what
making inferences and
absolutely
and educating guesses.
There were times though where they were absolutely stumped and they were like, Ganty, tell us what this is. I do not know. Sure, let me help you. And then what was great was after they really started to kind of see how the definitely how the play was structured. And then, as I would say, probably we broke it up into scenes, but different scenes than in the first folio. But after the first couple scenes, it just becomes automatic. Like, they just start to get it. And then sometimes they're like, I don't know what he's saying. We had to go back and talk about it. But our rehearsals would be, you know, the first time we'd read through it and we'd talk about the text. And then the next would be, as soon as they got it up and blocked it, they kind of understood more, like, with the direction of what they were supposed to do with their body.
Yeah.
So that helped deepen their understanding too.
Well, it's the same thing with anything. It's a muscle, isn't it? And then once you work that muscle, Shakespeare just becomes, that language just becomes something that you know.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Very cool. And I don't think I need to ask this question, but the audience, I think it sounds like you were successful on all fronts in terms of what you wanted for the play and then the outcome.
Yes, we wanted to make, like I said, an engaging, fun, and relevant show that would be remembered. And I remember some of my colleagues that when we said we were doing A Midsummer Night's Dream, they give you this terrified look and they go, are you sure? Like, did I hear you right? You're doing Shakespeare? And they're completely supportive, but they just think, oh my, they remember their experience and in stumbling through, you know, Shakespeare in high school or the first time they read it and thinking, what the heck is happening? I had one of my colleagues, my assistant principal, come up to me and said, she talked to the kids. She said, you guys, I've read this play 3 times. The first time was in high school. The second time was in when I was going through my undergrad. And then the third time was when I was going through my doctorate program. And I hated it. I didn't understand. I know, which is, she said, I couldn't understand. I didn't understand what was going on. I tried to connect to the characters. And she gets all kind of verklempt. And she's like, you guys, you made it so real for me and fun. She's like, I never would have thought I would have liked Shakespeare. But you guys, you have absolutely made me a fan. And that spoke so much. And to get these, writings back from the elementary school kids where they're drawing pictures of the characters and then they're writing what happened in the play. I'm like, oh my gosh, we did get through. So the language and how those kids were able to actually demonstrate the meaning did actually affect our audience. So that was very rewarding.
Oh my gosh. I can't think of anything more rewarding than for someone to say, I hate Shakespeare and you made it real.
Yeah.
That you was made really, it real. Oh, really Kelly, fun. That's so amazing.
Yeah.
That's awesome. Thank you so much for sharing this with us. And leave us with, for anyone out there who is terrified of putting up Shakespeare, what's the one thing you need to do as a director?
If you're terrified of putting up Shakespeare.
And you know you should do it.
And you know you should do it. Remember that the plays are so versatile. You can use it in any way that you want. So the language will be the least of your worries, and your kids will absolutely get it. They will. They are so geared now to figure things out and to fail a level and try again. They will absolutely 100% get it.
How interesting is that to say that these, our students are, they're geared to figure out things, to problem solve.
I think so. And I think, well, I mean, in theater, we could talk all day about how it's, you know, completely related to Common Core and we're doing 21st century skills all the time. Every single minute of the day, those kids are communicating, collaborating, being creative and critically thinking. They will do that because it's fun and they're problem solvers. So if you're worried about getting Shakespeare up on its feet, get your vision about, you know, like what you want to say with your play, and don't worry about the language. The kids will absolutely get it. And I think if you encourage them to play and see themselves in the play, they'll get it, no problem.
That's awesome. Thank you so much, Kelly.
Thank you.
All right, now I am talking to Lisa Houston. Hello, Lisa.
Hi, Lindsay.
Awesome. And you have directed A Midsummer Night's Dream. So my first question to you is, when you did it, why did you choose it?
Okay, so I've actually directed it 3 times.
Well, I stand corrected. Awesome.
Yeah, so the first time, I guess I chose it because we were in a new performance space. Like, we had just moved into our Black Box studio theater, and it felt like the type of show that we could really do well with, sort of using floor to ceiling and creating like a very textured world with a lot of color and interesting, you know, our tree was really interesting and levels. And so I think I chose it more for the setting at that particular time rather than for the Shakespeare language or that it fit certain actors that I had. Like, I think I actually really went after it because of the setting.
That's really interesting. I like that. And I like that it's like, look, this is a show that can really showcase a new space.
Yeah. So that was sort of my thinking back then. And then I've done it, I've done cuttings of it with other groups. And so one of those groups was a senior, like a group of seniors doing sort of an internship. And they were doing like plays within plays. So that we sort of focused on Act 5 for that. And then now we've just staged a 45-minute version of it that we took over to England to perform at a school, like our sister school in England. And so that I took a different approach, like a more simple approach. So
yeah,
that
I was going to say, like, it would be hard to, I think it's a really easy show to travel with, but we always get really caught up with Dream with the spectacle of the fairy tale, the costume of it.
Right. So what we did this time around was that everyone had jeans and Converse sneakers and a gray, like, t-shirt, show shirt that had sort of our trip imagery on the front and their character name on the back. And then, so we were just adding on, you know, capes, kind of tutu, fringy kind of things for the fairies, vests and aprons and things for the mechanicals, because there were some people playing mechanicals and fairies, or, you know, playing Oberon and Theseus. So that was a quick change that actor had to make. So in order to make the quick changes, we sort of, everyone had this basic costume on. And that sort of gave the spirit of like a traveling troupe, right? They were this group of people putting on a play within a play within a play. So that kind of worked out well. We really simplified, because originally we were thinking what you're thinking, sort of what our full scale Midsummer Night's Dream would be. And you can't really put all of that into suitcases and take it with you. So really scaled back.
You know, what's funny, though, is that probably was closer to the heart of the original production, because it would have been double cast and it would have been, you know,
more simple. Yeah. And it was funny because it seemed like we were, like, we kept saying, like, this play is our play. Like, we had moments of, like, this is the worst rehearsal ever, ever of a show. Because we were doing it on top of our main stage productions, you know? So we had these moments of, like, where I was Quince, like, literally being like, this is the worst idea we ever had to put on a show on top of our other shows. And then, but when we really stepped back and made everything more simple, so we had sort of this little pipe system. We had like PVC pipe that fit together to sort of hold a curtain and a garland, and then like a less elegant curtain for when the mechanicals did their show. you know, once we scaled really far back, it just really fit. You're right. It fit sort of the spirit of the play.
So then you're also left with the creation of the world is not in the spectacle of the setting or the costumes. The creation of the word world is in the words.
Yes, it's in the language. And that was a struggle for our actors, because they are used to when they do Shakespeare, we do it here at home and we have really elaborate settings and costumes and a very specific world. And for this, they felt like, wait, I'm wearing jeans and a t-shirt, like, help. You know, I don't feel like I'm in a forest. And we were like, yeah, but Oberon is telling us what that forest looks like. Or Titania is telling us about the plants of the forest. So we did have to sort of, we would always attend to the language, of course. When you're doing Shakespeare, language should come first, always. But I think in the last few productions our kids had been associated with in Shakespeare, they had relied on lighting and costume and sound and things that we weren't necessarily going to have. So then we had to sort of go back to square one again with the language. Like, what are those important words? And I think for American teenagers that attending to sort of the nouns and the verbs is really important. And knowing, like, what are the operative words that the audience is going to understand and catch? Like, they might not catch some of the antiquated language. They might not catch some of those little words, like, what is the difference between, you know, doth and does? But they are going to know, like, press, the word press. So how am I going to say press and what gesture am I going to use to really understand that Lysander doesn't want to be near Hermia right now, that he's like under a spell to love Helena. So I think I always tell them nouns and verbs are really important. And then sometimes they discover that actually, well, the pronoun might be important here because like I'm talking about her, you know, and I want the audience to understand that she is more beautiful than I am, and the boys like her more than they like me. So then sometimes the actor can discover other operative words, but I think if you start with the nouns and the verbs for American teenagers, that also helps them sort of scan the iambic pentameter, and it works for prose and verse. So that's sort of something I latch onto.
That's a really great tip. And it's also just, because that's what we talk about all the time is how difficult Shakespeare's language is. And it's like, and yet, if you can just get beyond those doths and those these,
yes.
there's such a universal, there's universality going on. And in this play, it's teenagers in love and teenagers fighting with each other and that the girl fight, you know, like when you talk about, it's like, how low am I? It's not out of the realm of relatability.
Right. And I think there's a lot of like parent child.
Yeah.
Relationships also, they're just so current for teenagers always. Like Oberon sort of treats Puck like a child, but then expects that child to like go take out the garbage and do, you know, like, you know, like 1 minute he's like scolding Puck but then he's like, okay, Puck, you've got to make it darker and use your voice to pretend you're Lysander. And, you know, so like it's like just like a parent being like, oh, your room's not clean, but go take the garbage out and sort the recycling. And, you know, so it's a lot of parent-child with not only just Aegeus and Hermia, but with the way Oberon works with Puck and Titania with the fairies, and the mechanicals are sort of in this weird family structure. So I think there's a lot for students to latch onto.
Yeah, awesome.
And you can really set it in any world, right? So you could set it in a time period. You could set it underwater in outer space. And that's what's so fun, I think, for students is that you can take sort of like almost any approach. And as long as you're staying really loyal to the language, I think it's always going to be a successful production.
Awesome. Exactly. Thank you so much, Lisa.
Sure. Thank you.
Okay, I am talking to Nick Cusimano. Hello, Nick.
Hello, how are you, Lindsay?
I am awesome today. So tell everybody where in the world you are.
I am in St. Louis, Missouri.
Awesome. I love St. Louis. And so we're talking about not only Shakespeare, we're talking about Midsummer Night's Dream, and we're talking about interpretation, vision for this particular show. And I can't wait to talk to you about your particular vision. So why did you choose this show to do when you were, you know, going to put it up? Why this one?
Well, this is my, I think it was my 20th year of teaching when I did this. I'm in my ending, my 21st. And I had yet to do a full-blown Shakespeare. I figured it was about time that I tackled the Bard.
You know, it's the thing that people, sometimes I just put it off and put it off. And because for as many students as I meet who are trepidatious around Shakespeare, I meet just as many adults, you know?
And usually I direct a musical, but Kevin, who I teach with, he wanted to do Pajama Game, which put me in the I got to do a straight show spot. And so I kept on kind of looking around, and I'm like, you know, maybe I do Shakespeare. And I've done Kiss Me, Kate, and Shakespeare in Hollywood, and I'm sure a couple other of those that kind of dance around it. But so I started thinking about it, and I think it was still July, and I hadn't really decided on the show yet. And I went to the Educational Theater Association conference that summer and saw my theater cast co-host, and we kind of talking, and I was kind of leaning towards Midsummer because I was already familiar with it, and then started thinking about how to interpret it. And somewhere, I guess on my drive to Cincinnati, Ohio, maybe the idea popped in my head, what about an 80s spin on it? And so started kind of going with the 80s spin. And, you know, then you think, okay, so what are those references from the 80s? Who's the best of wrapping up the 80s pop culture-wise? Well, it's John Hughes movies, at least for people my age, because those were the, you know, those were the movies that, you know, pulled me in. 16 Candles and Breakfast Club, and so started thinking about that, and Breakfast Club for the lovers. And so you had Hermia was Molly Ringwald, and Helena was Ally Sheedy, and then and I'm trying to remember, I have to look at my notes, but you have Bender.
Yep. What's her name, Allison?
Anthony Michael Hall character as the other guy.
Demetrius.
Emilio Estevez, sorry.
Ah.
So those two were Demetrius and Lysander, and then Anthony Michael Hall kind of did double John Hughes duty. He was Anthony Michael Hall, of course, and the nerd and Breakfast Club, and they came in as if they were going to detention, and the Duke was the vice principal, and luckily I had a suit that looked very similar to his in our stock, and so we started the scene as if they were in the Breakfast Club going to detention, and then he told them, you know, write an essay, what you think, instead of talking and sharing, they fell asleep, and lo and behold, the curtain opens, and we're on the set, and we kind of start the story, and then, so the fairies needed to be otherworldly, and so they were pop stars from TV at that age, and the other fairies were solid gold dancers.
Oh my gosh.
We had a great time with that. Bought some neon yellow sweatshirts, cut those
Oh, you
like
cut the arms
neckstands.
off. Oh my God, the
Yeah.
80s. Oh my gosh.
So I cut the neck part off, put them, I got leg warmers and put them in leotards. And so they did a dance at the beginning as we transition into Fairyland. And then our Puck was Ferris Bueller, because what could be better? Who encapsulate Puck better than Ferris Bueller? And the mechanicals were all the nerds from the John Hughes movies. So the lion was Ducky from Pretty in Pink. And I want to say Quince, but I could be remembering wrong.
Yeah, Quince.
One who plays Thisbe was Cameron Crowe. And so had to find the sports team shirt for him, and the two friends from 16 Candles, and then I'm probably missing one on there, but all the nerds from those movies. And Madonna was Titania, and Adamant was
Oh
Oberon.
my goodness.
And so, and the changeling boy, and this was just totally inspired from Audition. So I had a freshman boy come in who had bright pink hair. And it was like, because I hadn't really decided what to do with the changeling boy or how we were going to address that. And I was like, oh my goodness, I have Annie Lennox. He can sing Sweet Dreams. How can be better? And so we have all those fun 80s references tied in.
Now, did you have a, so I can already like I can already visualize what this looks like. Did you do the costume and the set design yourself, or did you just tell this all of these character references? Did you tell that to someone else and they just went to town?
Set was done by Kevin Manus and our theater design and technology students in our
Oh,
classes.
cool. That's cool.
The costume design, it's pretty much me. either pulling from our stock or ordering, like I found the Ferris Bueller jacket and vest for like $50 online, and had to order the one thing for Cameron's character,
Okay.
and Cyndi Lauper was like Mustard Seed. Susanna Hoff was Pease Blossom or Moth, and Tony Basil was another one, and they all sang a little lullaby. Of course, it didn't work till I think Annie Lennox happened.
Okay, so if you so you had to so if some so you did the costume, but if you had to, so obviously you had to sort of explain your vision to the design students. So what did you say to them, and did they, you know, because the 80s, I'm not gonna I fear to say it, but it was like 30 years ago. And not in the students' world. So what did they do? How did they do it?
So they kind of had to do some research, and some of this we kind of already talked about. We wanted, we had to show the Greek side when we dealt with the Duke, and so we had some multicolor, huge columns with kind of rainbow, because if you remember those kind of Lisa Frank stickers
Yeah.
and a Rubik's Cube that gave us kind of a throne and. With some levels,
Oh.
and then on the left, right side of the stage, we had lockers for them because we had to have that quintessential pose that matches the Breakfast Club poster. But on top of that, they incorporated some green into it, so it was leaves, and part of that to give us levels once again. Was videotapes that said, 16 Candles and the other movie references, Pretty in Pink. And then the front part of the stage was a boom box because, we had to have a mixtape. always. And to the right of the stage, to Tanya's bed area, was a 45 record.
Oh my goodness.
Way back when. And then on the left side of the stage, we kind of had some multicolored, or not multicolored, but bright colored pegs that they could sit onto.
It's so funny, eh? Because A Midsummer Night's Dream takes place in another world, and the 80s are another world, you know? when you think about it and look back, I mean, that was my, we're the same age, so I'm just hearing all this and I'm just like, oh.
Yeah, it's like reliving high school, but without, you know, all the, without having to go through puberty.
Without actually be a teenager.
All the best parts.
Okay, so let's start with the actors. So how did your actors respond to this take?
They had a great time. I did have to, you know, some of the references we had to explain, or some of the things because of the movie's ratings. I'm like, you're going to have to watch this on your own to get a sense of what was kind of going on, and just a little bit of that style. And then I just love the soundtrack too, because, you know, there's that up and down, I shall spin them, or yeah. I think it's been maybe good. You know, dead or alive, you spin me right now. That whole part. And when we had a whole dance break in there, so we referenced the Carla DeVito song that they dance around to in Breakfast Club, and they do the back and forth stomp, and the Ally Sheedy character falls on the floor, and we just had a whole bunch of fun with that. When she first sees Bottom, when Titania first sees Bottom, and she's Madonna, she sings You Are My Lucky Star. And so I just had so many songs.
Yeah.
It was like directing a musical.
Yeah.
The cues.
And how did...
Luckily, they just lip sync, so we didn't have to worry about being on key. But...
Right. And so how did being in this world and having very specific characters to play, how did this help your actors deal with the text?
I was very lucky that, especially my lovers, they handled the text really well. They just were naturals with it, which is always good, but we just took the time to explore. I also used, and still use, with when we do our Shakespeare unit, the Commedia Zuppa, Todd, and Allison Williams kind of guide to that. That we took from them, I want to say 15 years ago.
Yeah, probably. Todd Espelin, we'll give him a shout out. Todd Espelin and Allison Williams were Commedia Zuppa, and I know that Todd Espelin does a lot of Shakespeare stuff. He does a lot of stuff for us making Shakespeare friendly.
And so that I kind of had them do that as their actor work. And we just spent time with it and did a 90-minute version of it, so we could take the time to kind of delve into it. And I think the hardest part, the language you just kind of have to keep on working with it. And then once you get that rhythm and it gets in their head, brain, mind, body, then they, you know, do really well with it. And you do, you know, just have to take that time to explore it.
I think that's the
key. Give yourself the time to explore, too.
Yeah, that's the key. That it doesn't really matter how, what everything looks like. If they're not connecting to the text, you know, there's going to be something missing. So you're absolutely right. You got to take the time.
And it's, I think Midsummer is one of the most successful ones, because when you have a comedy, the broad comedy to play, it's very physical. Shakespeare already writes that physicality in there for you. So he's helped us out with that one where, you know, it may be more challenging to do a history play. Mm-hmm. And I haven't worked my way towards that.
But... Oh, man, you take one step, one step at a time. Awesome. Oh, Nick, thank you for sharing your vision of A Midsummer Night's Dream with us. I just think that it was so funny when you were describing it. That's the first thing that came to mind. I'm like, you know, it is another world. It's such, and it's so specific, like just like Dream is. So I think that I imagine your audience ate it up.
Yeah, we had a great time with it. It was, you know, it's kind of my little bit of chance of being semi like a playwright, where I can at least try some different ideas and see how they work.
Awesome. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Thank you, Nick and Lisa and Kelly and Marsha. Before we go, let's do some theater folk news. It's a play feature. It's a play feature. It's time to feature a play. And since we're talking Shakespeare, it makes sense that we should feature a play that features Shakespeare. Shakespeare. I can say that three times fast, right? Okay, so Postcards from Shakespeare by Allison Williams looks at writer's block. More specifically, Shakespeare's writer's block. He is in a funk. Nothing inspires him. The best he can come up with is, now is the winter of our irritation. Nah. So he pleads to the one person who can help him, Queen Elizabeth I, Queen Lizzie, who could be a writer herself if she wasn't so busy crushing the Welsh. Yay, she sends Shakespeare around the world in 30 minutes. Denmark, Venice, Egypt, and you must join his whirlwind tour as he desperately searches for material. Star-crossed lovers, or surprise death, or shipwrecks. Don't forget that something is rotten in the state of Denmark. Well, that was very exciting. I want to read this play. So you can read sample pages for this script at theaterfolk.com, or you can catch the link in the show notes. That's theaterfolk.com/episode164. Finally, where can you find this podcast? We post new episodes every second Tuesday at theaterfolk.com and on our Facebook page and Twitter. You can find us on youtube.com/theaterfolk and on the Stitcher app. You can subscribe to TFP on iTunes. All you have to do is search for the word, that very special word, theater folk. Because that's what we are, right? That's why you, me, all of us, we is theater folk. I love that. And that's where we're going to end. Take care, my friends. Take care.